make it real or else forget about it.
Hello, human beings. Welcome to Insert Credit Show, episode 101, and then 1 again. 111.
111. 111.
By the time you listen to this on your listening-only devices, you will have heard two weird different episodes that we did. But this one's going to be a little more normal if the episode that we did for 108 was considered normal. So we've got me, Brandon Sheffield, Tim Rogers, who's Tim Rogers, and Frank Savaldi, who is Frank Savaldi.
Usually,
yeah, I'm one of those people.
They're all there, and I was just in Japan with Tim.
Yeah,
and there I was purchasing some video games because I play Asia, as you. Insert credit, long-time associates may remember. PlayAsia.
They were a sponsor of Insert Credit, weren't they?
Yeah, they were a sponsor of Insert Credit.
Nice.
Yeah, and I was able to get some of that ad revenue and use that to purchase some video games. When I went to Japan, or in order to not feel bad about purchasing video games when I went to Japan.
Oh, yeah.
Because I forgot that there was some ad revenue in there, so I took it. Anyway, the point is, I bought old video games, and I thought to myself, why am I collecting these things? I mean, I know the answer. I know the answer, the real answer, but in a larger sense, why collect and why acquire? So, Tim, you don't do that too much anymore, but you used to do some of it, and you still have some things that you want.
I think the games I had, I tend to buy. I played a bunch of them. I mean, I got them for playing. Mostly I was...
Yes.
Had a thing where I had to build, like, a library, you know?
Yeah, yeah. That's what I mean. I don't mean, like, collect just to collect. I mean, when we were in Japan, you were buying a few specific things to try to have a certain kind of thing go on. And Frank, you have the magazines and whatnot. So,
you know, Tim justifies his collecting as wanting a library of a specific aesthetic. You know, in the same way that I justify my collecting of magazines as wanting a reference library as some kind of tool/public service, right?
Uh-huh.
And but you know, I think even if you have a valid justification for collecting, you're still acquiring physical things and putting them together in a space, and that is kind of weird.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. So it's, you know, there's. Like, to what extent is there some, and this is a little sort of embarrassing for me to talk about, to what extent is there some I want to be known for liking cool things mixed up in there? Like, this is part of who I am is the fact that I like these kinds of cool things.
Yeah.
Okay, at least for mine, I don't really think of this stuff as being all that cool. I just think it's useful. I do have that small video game collection, though. What I call my top shelf, which I think you're both familiar with, where I just kind of put nice boxed copies of games that are important either to history or to me. And I collect them as if they are first prints, like they're books. Well, I collect the first editions of games as if their books, because I don't think people do that too often. So, you know, the Japanese Super Mario Brothers, the Commodore 64 Tetris, you know. And yeah, I do think a certain part of that is showing that I I don't know, is some kind of reflection of me, right? Which I think is what you're saying. Like, I consider these things important. When people look at my top shelf and see these things, I want them to have some insight into who I am, I guess.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I've got these Saturn PC Engine games everywhere, and I guess I've talked about it enough that now I get an email or two per week with someone saying, like, yeah, I'm thinking of getting into the Saturn. What do you recommend that I buy? Which is kind of weird and funny. But I don't know. I guess that's the result. But there's a line that I think we all would have to draw between things that we buy and just stuff that is stupid to collect, but it's quite personal. Like I would say, yeah, for my money, collecting amiibos is stupid. Right. But
yeah.
But I mean, I've got almost 300 Saturn games. That's pretty stupid.
I think you and I and actually probably all three of us have some slight rebellion toward things that are made specifically to be collectible.
Yeah.
And I think the amiibo thing is definitely part of that. Like amiibos make me feel gross. Like I want nothing to do with them. I am like somehow anti amiibo, even though I think they're fun little toys and I think that the tech is neat and everything, but just because they're you know, the supply is limited in a way as to make them collectible, and because they are made in a way that encourages you to, like, have a full set or you're a noob, you know, like, I think I'm just against that, and I draw the line there. And I think that's, I mean, I actually used to collect, you know, old Nintendo games myself. I used to have, like, 300 of them in the box and everything.
Yeah.
And I think a large part of why I sort of rejected doing that and started collecting some of the things I consider more interesting is because there sort of emerged this mentality of the NES library being this thing you're supposed to complete. And I don't like people telling me what to do, is I think what it comes down to.
Yeah, I feel that way. Also, I mean, even if they were things with no limited supply, I wouldn't want those. I mean, even I feel like I can put myself into my shoes as a child pretty easily, and I don't know if I would like Skylanders either. You can't move their limbs.
Yeah.
They're just kind of standing in like a statue pose. That weirds me out.
Yeah, I wonder about the... Because I remember how I played with, you know, Ninja Turtles and Food Fighters and Rock Lords. I don't know if you know those last two, but
Rock Lords.
They were like Transformers that turned into rocks. They all transformed into different rocks.
You were getting your action figures at the Big Lots, it sounds like.
I didn't know what a Big Lots was. I got them at the thrift store, or occasionally Toys R Us, but mostly
Big Lots is a thrift store that sells new stuff.
That's right.
that's what a Big Lots is.
But you know, I was playing around with these things and giving them imaginary scenarios and stuff, and I was actually thinking this morning for some reason about Skylanders toys. And
nice,
since there are so many worlds that a child could already put them in and have them do stuff, does it affect the way that they play with them? Like G.I. Joe's, people that knew what G.I. Joe was, because I didn't really, I just knew what the toys were, they would go along, not storyline specifically, but they would be kind of within canon as much as they could be. They'd be like, this is a good guy, this is a bad guy. They're on, and the bad guys are on this team, and the good guys are on this team, and I had no idea. And so I wonder to what extent the video game affects the imagination play of a Skylanders toy.
I'm, you know, like Tim, trying to put myself in my kiddie shoes here again, and I don't think that would affect me very much. Like, it's,
yeah.
I don't think the continuity of the Ninja Turtles cartoon really affected the storylines that I came up with when I was playing.
But were you like, Bebop and Rocksteady and April are friends and they're going on a picnic?
No, yeah, there were clear divides in terms of, like, you know, yeah. Okay, so yeah, that's true, yeah, in that, like, the Shredder and his people were, you know, that organization, and the Turtles were their own thing. There was a clear, like, good versus evil thing, I guess. But I don't know if that's the same as, like, the rules in Skylanders being what, you know, they have these specific powers
Well, yeah, you put them on the portal and they show up in the game, and then
right.
they're doing yeah. what the game designers want them to do.
But they also don't, I mean, it's not really like a narrative-driven experience, I don't think.
Not exactly. I mean, there's something going on there.
Yeah, but I don't know if it's enough of a narrative that's like hammered into a kid's head where that is the world that they're in, but maybe I'm wrong.
I mean, kids still have imagination, of course, and I'm sure they're gonna do stuff. I was just wondering to what extent they're like, okay, this guy's got this power, so he can do this stuff, or if they're like, but what if he could, etc. I don't know. Anyway, that's not the real point. But like Amiibos and all that, it kind of reminds me of the story Tim has told of his brother and the Beanie Babies, where
yeah.
Like creating a false economy there.
Yeah, they're talking about how much money they're worth. Oh, this one's yeah. worth $200. It's like, oh, why don't you go sell it? I don't want to. Why don't you go sell it? I don't know.
Could appreciate in value, you know.
Yeah, it could go up. It's like, well, yeah. And I think those Beanie Babies are still in a bunch of plastic boxes in the closet.
And there's a weird thing with value when you're collecting things or buying things that you like, just in general. I feel like if you have that mindset at all, my father would always pick up something that he saw at a thrift store or something, because he'd be like, oh, I think this is worth money. And you know, regardless of whether it was, eBay didn't exist. Yeah. He didn't have a way to sell that, really. He needed a fence, is what my dad needed. Someone to shift all of these goods away. But for me, the price that is associated with the thing that I buy, there's something to that. When I get something that's worth $60 in general, the average price is $60 on Amazon, and I get it for $4. Somehow, in some terrible part of me, the worth of that game, that my personal copy, has increased because I paid so much less than what I could have paid. I don't know if you feel that way at all.
Yeah, sure, and I think that's just the feeling of having beaten the system. More than anything.
Yeah. Yeah. And but there's also, to some extent, like, an I know what stuff is kind of in there too.
Sure. Yeah.
Yeah.
No, that's absolutely true. I don't know if I'm really grossed out by that so much, because it's like, you know, for both of us, we have that specific thing that we are acquiring, right? That has its limits, and yeah. And to celebrate being able to do that better than other people do it, I don't think there's anything wrong with that. Like, that's yeah. that's just giving yourself props for being smart.
Yeah, it. You know, I go to flea markets and stuff with my girlfriend, and she buys. We split off, and she buys high-end clothing for way cheap, and I buy video games for less than they're worth, and then at the end of the day we're like, yeah, we got some cool stuff.
It does get into kind of a weird area sometimes, though, where, like, last time I went to a flea market, This guy had a backlit Game Boy Advance SP, same one I have, same color and everything.
Yeah.
But it was $15, so I'm like, I have to buy this. Like, why did I have to buy that?
Yeah, yeah. That's the kind of stuff that I'm talking about where like, okay, so I was in Korea, and there was this huge stack of Saturn games. It was like 8 stacks of 20 high Saturn games with a sign on top that said 5,000 won, which was about $4 at the current exchange rate of a few weeks ago. And in there were like 8 copies of Assault Suit Lanos 2, which goes for between $20 and $35.
I like that game.
It's a good game. And likewise, the same amount of Albert Odyssey and a whole bunch of one specific Tactics Ogre. All of those, if I had bought them for $4, I could have made like 5 times my investment if I bought them and brought them back. But I thought that would be kind of a crappy thing to do, because maybe there are other people walking around who want that game, and if they find it for $4, they're going to be really happy. So I left them there. But briefly, I thought about buying them all and selling them, and I definitely know other people who would do that. And I can imagine that's probably what happened immediately after I didn't buy them.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah.
Owned.
So, like, I don't know. What's the point? What's the point in trying to do anything good? No, but I also thought about I was thinking about this when I was with Tim and Super Potato in Ikebukuro, and I was considering whether I should buy these two games that were relatively expensive, but they were about $30 to $50 cheaper than they would be anywhere else, and the exchange rate was better than it was ever going to be in Japan, or than it had been in like 10 years. And so I decided to get them. And so what is the most money that you would pay for something that you really want within the sphere of things that you might collect and given your current financial situation?
Oh, man. So, I mean, are we talking about video games or are we talking about other stuff?
No, you can get into like synthesizers or guitars or whatever you want.
Yeah. Well, so I used to kind of collect guitar stuff, and there was the first edition Digitech Whammy, which usually was going for about $1,000 at the time. I found one for $500, and I didn't realize that I was willing to pay that much for it, and I got it, and it ruled. And that was cool. But I can't really say that I really, really want any stuff that I think is rare, you know, like it's the kind of stuff that people sit around talking about wanting.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, God, I don't know. Like, I'm perfectly content with, and I mean, this doesn't mean I'm immune to wanting to collect stuff, but I'm perfectly content with Radiant Silver Gun on Xbox Live Arcade, you know.
Right.
I really don't need it on the Sega Saturn. Is there a reason I should need it? I mean, if you handed it to me, I'd take it, you know? Like, if you were like, hey, can you hold this forever? I'd be like, yeah, okay. I would totally take it, but I can't think of wanting to actually put the money down and buy it for $160?
Yeah. I'm going to get further into that stuff a bit later, but like I was saying when we were at that Super Potato, you know, this Astra Superstars that I bought for about $76, and usually it goes for about $130.
Yeah.
You know, it's a fair amount of, it's quite a bit of money for me to spend. And also, I could burn it and play it, or I could emulate it and play it.
Yeah.
I don't need to own the physical thing. So, like, what's that about? Why bother? I don't know, Frank. You've had to organize the purchase of much larger items for the purposes of preservation, but that feels quite different.
Yeah, it's not collecting.
Yeah, that's different. No, that's completely different. And you know, the answer to your question of like what's the upper limit of what you'd spend if it was something you wanted, like I don't really have an answer to that. It's just whatever disposable cash I have at that moment, you know, is my upper limit. I don't know that I've ever been like, oh, I have that much and I really want that, but I don't want to spend it. I've always just been like, yeah, I have it, sure, here. Which is bad for savings, but you know, it's fine. I'm doing okay.
I think so, like, that's how I used to be.
Okay. I have these glasses. So anyone who doesn't know, I guess I collect handmade eyeglass frames by the maker who made John Lennon's glasses in Japan. And I'm wearing a pair of them right now. So it's there is one pair that I bought in 2007 that is like the pair that I most frequently wear. It was in all of my Facebook photos. I realized once it got stolen from me, somebody stole my backpack in San Francisco, I realized that it was part of my face. And by wearing the other pair of glasses I had, it just was not the same human face. And that I needed them in order to complete my face and get my identity back. So that was weird, but at the same time that sort of launched me into wanting those glasses, and I got a pair of them, miraculously located a brand new pair, which is insane. I feel like a criminal every time I wear them because it's like these should be in a museum. They're a handmade pair of glasses and there's only 50 pairs in the world, and they're just hand-carved with the maker's mark etched in 18-karat gold on the inside of one of the arms of the glasses. It's like, this is kind of a fantastic item that I own. And so, yeah, recently I've become somewhat interested in purchasing another of the 50 pairs that were ever made. And it's really hard to find, and it occupies about 20 minutes of my day every day, is checking all the usual suspects to see if any other pairs have surfaced. I know that all of them were bought within maybe like 6 months of being made one at a time, this particular model. And most of them, like somebody bought these glasses, not the ones I'm wearing right now for anybody watching, but somebody bought them and then just never wore them and kept them for 7 years thinking they could sell them someday. And this is something that I wonder about collectors. And then they let them go for a very like reasonable price, like very little over the original sale price of the glasses. So they just had a whole bunch of stuff lying around. They're like, well, I guess I'll get rid of this. Like, I don't need this. Is that what it was? Or like, so that's the thing. So anyway, I would pay kind of a lot for another pair of those black glasses with the gold etchings in them. So, yeah.
That's not so much collecting, though. That's, I don't know, that feels different to me.
Well, no, it would be collecting because I wouldn't wear them. I want to buy an older pair, like a used pair, so that I can then put the brand new pair that I have away and like never wear them because I feel terrible wearing them. You know?
Okay. So it's not for the sake of a backup. It's that you want to have, you like these glasses so much that you want to have a pristine version of them. It's the equivalent of people like sending their comics in to be graded. And like in this hard slab where you can't enjoy it anymore. It's just because like they like this thing so much that they want a pristine version of it to I don't know to what, you know, to
yeah, I just want to put it away.
It's kind of like sealed game collecting in a way, in that like our new artist Catherine owns a copy of Rule of Rose that she paid 90 euros for.
Cool game.
And it's sealed, and she's never going to open it. But she plays it on an emulator on her PC because it's a better experience anyway, and then she just keeps this object because she loves it so much.
Yeah.
I almost understand it, but then like I go down to my PS2 library in my house, and I see games that I just haven't opened. I just happen to have not opened them. And they're like RPGs mostly. English translated RPGs that I just didn't open because they were daunting and I didn't get around to them. And now I look at how much those are worth on eBay and I get nervous about opening them. And that's a feeling that I don't want to have.
Yeah, and I get the sealed game thing quite a bit. Like, you know, the games I was mentioning earlier, or even I have that set of LucasArts adventure games because they mean a lot to me. And I don't install a 5 1/4 drive to like play the original EGA version of Monkey Island. You know, like I have a box that's on my shelf that like once in a while I'll open and like play with a little newsletter and stuff that came in there, I guess, but. Really, I have that just to have on a shelf, and if I play the game, I'm just downloading it. I'm pirating it, even though I own it.
Yeah.
Because there's no reason to play that original media, so I get it. And, you know, it being shrink-wrapped or not, you know, I just don't care. I just care that it's a nice-looking copy. Like, if I happen to get it shrink-wrapped for the same price, I'd probably just keep it shrink-wrapped, but I don't necessarily need that in my life.
Yeah, I wouldn't purposefully buy a shrink wrapped thing, but if it's something that is shrink wrapped and I don't need to open it, then I feel like, well, maybe I shouldn't. But,
yeah.
But that's a weird feeling. I think. I saw this thing on Facebook. There was a guy.
Oh, no, don't look at that.
Who I know, it's a mistake. There was a guy talking about. I don't know if you've seen these little. Cartridges made in Japan, cartridges for your smartphone that you can plug it in there, and it'll essentially what it does, they're these little cartridge looking dongles that unlock existing content in games. It's essentially really clunky physical DRM, and this guy was like awesome. And I was like, can you explain to me why this is awesome? And he's like, well, it's obvious. And I was like, it's not obvious. Just tell me. And he's like, well, I think cartridges are great, and I miss cartridges, and so I think this is fantastic. But ultimately, it's like you're buying this piece of plastic to get in the way of something you already bought. And it's strange, that kind of... It's like
I think that's different. Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
No, it is.
That's exactly what I was gonna say. Like, it's not a collector thing. It's a nostalgia.
No.
Thing. It's just, you know, the older I get, the more I realize that almost all problems come down to some people want things to change and some people want things to stay the same. And like, you know, this nostalgic people who want things to be like they were at their happiest point in their life. You know, that's a type of person, and that's what that product preys on, I think.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I think it's interesting that, like, you know, we collect this old stuff, you know, from, frankly, what were probably happier times in our lives from that era, but I don't think we do it in a nostalgic way. I don't pine for the days of physical media and, you know, and like going to the video game store. Like I am very much over that. I'm like Tim. I'm fine with my digital copy on Xbox Live Arcade. Although more specifically, I'm fine with pirating my ROMs and don't need the original cartridges. But that's it's a totally different thing and
so,
that's weird in its own way.
So while I was in Japan, I bought. Dragon Quest V for the PlayStation 2 and Dragon Quest V for the Nintendo DS. And I already own a copy of Dragon Quest V for the Super Famicom. And I kind of forgot I did that, and I opened up my suitcase. By the way, Brandon, your stuff is on my sofa. I like
it's all. I'm gonna go get it.
Yeah, so come on over and get it anytime. I'm here all the time because I live here. I just gutted it open, and I was like showing Kerwin my games, and I'm taking them out, and I'm like, yeah, I got Dragon Quest, and I'm just looking at them all sitting on the sofa, and I got them all specifically to play them, right? Like, yeah. I will play all the way through Dragon Quest V on my DS. I used to have it, and I lost it, and the reason I bought it was not to regain what I had lost, but so that I could play Dragon Quest V on my DS again, because I really, really, really like that game a lot. And I bought Dragon Quest V on the PlayStation 2 because I want to play it on my PlayStation 2, on my TV with component cables and a nice progressive scan mode. So, yeah, but then I realized I have 3 copies of Dragon Quest V, and I really like the box art of all of them, and they're all on my shelf. I have this game shelf that's just games I like and like playing with box art that I like and like looking at. So that's weird. But I noticed that everything I bought in Japan is a Dragon Quest game with fantastic box art.
Yeah.
So I'm just looking at it. I should take an Instagram picture of all of them. Just be like, yeah, here's my DQ. Deal with it. Because there's
deal with it quietly.
Deal quietly with my Dragon Questings.
Yeah. So this kind of brings me to my midpoint question.
MPQ.
Which is, are games from the past better than games of today?
No.
That's a tough question.
I don't think games of the past are better than games of today, but...
why don't you play any?
any what?
Games of today.
I'm playing Undertale right now.
UT.
Right. Well, usually when we have this conversation, you're like, I don't play any of that stuff.
Yeah, but Undertale
I don't play very many. Okay, so the reason that I will often play older games more than I play modern games is the same reason that I don't like go to the movie theater that often, which is that there's so many games throughout history that I haven't played that are proven to be good, you know, that are known quantities, that I don't think it's worth the risk of playing very many new ones unless, you know, the feedback I'm seeing has just been so spectacular that it's irresistible to me. Like, I've never played through a Dragon Quest game, you know, like, and I know they're all probably pretty good. I've never played through Chrono Trigger. I've never played through so many things. I've never played Panzer Dragoon Saga. Yeah. And there's just this gigantic library of amazing games that I can play at any time, and I don't know why I'd choose to gamble on something new over doing that.
Uh-huh.
But also, I do just kind of experiment with crappy old games just looking around, and I think that's just a result of me not being afraid of piracy and flashcards and just being able to load up a random Genesis game for 2 minutes and decide I never want to play it again. You know, all I've lost there is 2 minutes.
Yeah. I think for me there's something else in there where with like a Genesis game, if I remember I went to Spencer Yip's house, the head of Silicon Era.
Former.
He's doing a video game company now. But he had like these Chinese Final Fantasy games for the Genesis.
You mean China Fantasy?
Yeah, China Fantasy.
Oh, yeah.
Yes.
Podcast over.
That's right.
I did.
And I was pretty excited about it, in spite of the fact I knew I wasn't going to be able to play it. I cannot read the language of Chinese.
Right.
You were excited about it in sight of...
In sight of my spelf. And to me, I think one of my favorite things about I don't know if it's collecting or if it's just excavating these experiences. It's discovery, which is so much harder for me now.
Yeah.
Because there's just so much stuff, but it's fun to be able to. It's like you were talking about with the proved thing. Like, I know that I liked some games on the Genesis, for example. And of course I haven't played all of them, but when I'm presented with one that I had no idea existed, or nobody had any idea existed, you know, outside of a few people in China, that's extra exciting to me, more than if someone did something new. To some extent. I mean, something new would have to, it would have a lot more to prove to me to get me a little bit excited. The new thing I would probably rather play. I would have a better time playing it, but I wouldn't be like, oh man, guess what just happened? This game came out. You know?
Well, and obviously I relate as someone who hunts down Nintendo Entertainment System games that never came out, right?
Yeah.
And it's like most of them are garbage, but I'm really excited to see any new game that was developed within that system's lifetime, you know?
It's even like another piece of the puzzle.
Exactly, and even though I haven't like played all the ones that did come out, you know, that doesn't seem to matter to me. There is something appealing about finding something new, and I don't know if I know exactly what that is. Is it just like, you know, the excitement of the hunt, of discovery? Is that really all it is?
I don't think so. I think a big part of it is when you, I would say all of us have amassed a particular like set of knowledge. We've got like a weird knowledge base, and it's pretty full within the areas of things we're interested in, but it's not completely full. And if it's like, oh my goodness, there's a way for me to increase my insane laser focus on this topic, it's exciting, because it's like you think you're done with this thing that has somewhat consumed and fulfilled you, and then you're not done, and it's like, oh man, gotta get it.
Well, and I'm at the point specifically with, you know, one of my weird things, which is the unreleased NES games, where like I will make a very minor discovery, like this game, GamePro mentioned it in like a review of the CES very briefly, but that's it. Whoa, look at this. I have this paperwork from Nintendo that shows it in their actual release window. So I now have like a primary source that this existed, as opposed to a magazine reporting on it. And like little things like that are still exciting to me. And that's
right.
It's just what you're saying. It's just expanding on that thing that I know really, really well, probably better than anybody at this point. And it's like there's still more, you know, that life is beautiful. There's discoveries every day.
That's right. Yeah. So Tim, are games of the past better than games of today?
That's a really big, difficult question.
Like, no, I know.
For example, Dragon Quest V is better than a lot of games today.
Yeah.
But I mean, having played Dragon Quest VI, VII, VIII, and IX. Eight particularly, I know that the writer, director, designer of Dragon Quest V is probably able to make a game better than Dragon Quest V, and maybe that's Dragon Quest XI. Is that really a game of today? Like, maybe that's a game of yesterday.
That's the point.
Like, like, what other games am I excited about, like, coming soon? I don't know. I feel like Video Ball is as good as some games of yesterday.
So what?
Oh, I do want to answer that in another way, which is that I think all of us have a preference for games with an artistic vision that also had enough resources to see that vision through. And I don't think that kind of game exists very often anymore.
Yeah.
And so in that sense, yeah, maybe older games are better than current games. I can see a future where we come back around to that, but I don't see that happening for a while.
So the theme of this episode, as has been perhaps obvious, is the thought of nostalgia. I've been thinking about this because it's weird how it feels like in the last 10 years that has become an industry much more than ever before.
Yeah.
You know, our movies are about that, and our game collecting is about that, and, mm-hmm. and some of game development is about that. Mm-hmm. Books are about that. That Ready Player One thing is just about, do you remember the 80s? Yes, no. If yes, then please enjoy this book. Or try to, you know, whatever. and yeah, my girlfriend, who is a biology major, was telling me that the part of the brain, which I have already forgotten what the name of it is, she told me, but I forgot. She told
probably the hippocampus. I don't know.
No, it's not that one. It's like a nucleo thingy something. Anyway, nuclear inversus. Wow, I made that up.
That one.
Anywho, is at its largest when you're a teenager, and then it shrinks. It gets smaller. Mm. So, like, your capacity to enjoy is at its greatest at that time, and then you have less after that. But you have less fit actual ability to enjoy things. And so this explains to me completely why you see these constant articles from journalists who are, you know, in our age group being like, you know what? Symphony of the Night is the best game ever, and here's why.
It's the best.
But here's why ultimately boils down to I played it in high school.
Yeah. Oh. Yep. I think that's true.
Yeah. And a lot of people get real mad and weird when someone's like, I'm like really sleepy. A lot of people get real mad and weird when kids try to be like, I don't know, I remember seeing people like, there are kids who like Star Wars Episode One more than Empire Strikes Back, and people on Facebook are like, what is the meaning of this? Why would they think that? And it's like, well, I don't know. Like, maybe because they were kids when they saw it.
Yeah.
Or, you know, or early teens or preteens.
Yeah, like, it bothers me that people today will say that, you know, stuff from their childhood was objectively better, but they don't have a reason, because there isn't a reason. And this got me to thinking about what are the new video game experiences that people in 10 or 20 years are going to feel this kind of nostalgia for. I actually wrote a big list of a bunch of them that I thought of, but I want to hear your thoughts.
Before you read that list, I want to express my theory about Dragon Quest and Pokemon, which very often, strangely, you will see journalists, bloggers, and critics who otherwise do not care commenting on how the series just refuses to change. It's frustrating that Pokemon is still the same game. And it's like, well, yeah, but it's new and it has better graphics. It's technologically upgraded. It's civic engineering at a point, you know?
Mm-hmm.
They're just polishing the service and bringing it up to date because it's a service. And I hate calling something as a service.
You don't need like a chair to radicalize what it's doing. You just want to sit on it and have it function for you.
Yeah. And kids experience that service, that good, that Dragon Quest, that new Dragon Quest, that new Pokemon, and they can have that nostalgia for it. You know, like later. I mean, it's the same thing. It's the same quality. And interestingly, if one's mind is open enough, one can play a new Pokemon. Now, see, the thing is, I was too old when the first Pokemon came out, so I kind of missed the boat on this. But,
yeah.
like, I was already in college, et cetera, but one can play a new Pokemon as a grown-up and be, like, still kind of connecting and bonding with the children of that era who are playing it, and then agree with them, except then you get into the arguments of which Pokemon is the best, and those usually revolve around what you played when you were a preteen or whatever. And Dragon Quest is immune to it as well, because the series mechanically doesn't change. But when a new Dragon Quest comes out and I play it, I remember playing an old Dragon Quest whose story might be drastically different.
Yeah.
And I remember it at a different age. I remember the age I was then, and I'm experiencing the nostalgia because it's so pure and true and real about itself, about what it used to be, that I mean, in a way, I feel like Dragon Quest is the perfect experience of nostalgia, because it's new and old at the same time, and God darn it, people should respect that.
You know, when you said... when you said, I think it was you, or I don't know if it was you or Frank, but that you can't really go back and insert yourself into that time and, like, play the game again and experience yeah. that kind of thing. There, I've been having some stuff with that. Like, you know, I wrote an article about it on Insert Credit back in the old days. Like trying to go back to my mom's house and playing. You know, like East Books 1 and 2 using the maps that I had made in, you know, when I was 14 or whatever. And you know, not feeling the same way, but I remembered that time. I remembered how I felt when I was doing all of those things. Like it brought back memory, the way, like, you know, you'll smell something and you'll be like, oh man, that one time I went to the beach.
Smells, like, and air temperatures.
Yeah.
Like exact air temperatures and humidity and barometric pressures.
Yeah, those are strongly associated with memory. But I feel like if you get yourself into the right environment, probably the right air temperature and smells while you're playing an old video game, you can sort of get back there. And another weird thing you could do is, like, I played through Shining Force 3 on the Saturn, and now I have Shining Force 3 scenarios 2 and 3, which are Japanese only and I did not have access to at the time. Now I can continue the story that I started in high school. That's kind of interesting in a way.
Yeah.
But back to the question, do you all have any examples that you can think of experiences that kids of, let's say, between like 5, 10 years ago and now are going to feel nostalgic for 10 to 20 years in the future? So we're getting, like, people who are, let's say, 18 or 19 today.
Mm-hmm.
Through the kids who are like 7 today.
Yeah, it's, I mean, like, I'm tempted to go straight to mobile just because of how many people, you know, play mobile games. But I mean, maybe I just haven't been keeping up enough on mobile games people are actually playing to know. I mean, like, well, there is going to be, and this is the obvious, you know, like when you think of a popular mobile game, what do you think of? But, like, people are going to be nostalgic for the original Angry Birds.
Yeah, totally.
Without a doubt.
In 20 years, I don't think there's going to be Angry Birds, and people are going to be like, wow, man, remember Angry Birds?
No, there probably will be some Angry Birds somewhere, because it's, like, kind of a cheap game to make when it comes down to it. But, you know, that they're going to be nostalgic for the originals in the same way that people are nostalgic for, I don't know, Sonic the Hedgehog now, even though there's still Sonic the Hedgehog games.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's the first one that came to mind for me. I don't know, all the ones that come to mind for me are pretty obvious, like the Halo series. You know, that is a meaningful series to a lot of people. That's a world that that people lived in for substantial amounts of time. And I think that that's going to, you know, maintain.
Yeah. Well, like, thinking a little broader about that sort of thing, I feel like people, like, really soon are going to be nostalgic for when AAA was king, like AAA console was the thing. Like PlayStation 3, 360, everything was trying to look good and be big. And, you know, they'll of course remember, you know, Mass Effect and whatever. But I feel like at a certain point, people are going to go back and they're going to start looking at the mid-tier stuff, and they're going to be like, oh man, Two Worlds 2, check out this weird thing.
Yeah.
Or they're going, like, to be like, you know what, Bomberman Act Zero, it had some good points, and I'm going to tell you what they are. You know,
yeah, like, they're going to discover games like Enslaved, Journey to the West and stuff, and be like,
yeah.
Wow, yeah.
Yeah.
Rules.
I feel like that's...
Sort
that's
of.
The... Go ahead.
That game, Enslaved, Journey to the West, sort of rules.
Yeah.
Yeah, I didn't like it, but I know that y'all did, and that's cool.
You didn't play that much of it, though, did you?
I played enough to know it wasn't really for me, but I didn't think it was bad. It just wasn't for me.
You know, I never played it, but it came out when I was working at 1UP, and I forget who it was. I think it was Mike Nelson at 1UP. He just brought me over to his desk because he's like, I know you didn't play this game and you're probably not going to, but I want you to see the ending. I'm like, all right. And he showed me the ending and I was like, I'm very interested in whatever that was. You know, like, it's a weird way to introduce someone to a game, but the ending was so weird, but not, you know, in an overt way that I was like, there's no way the game that preceded this couldn't have been at least interesting. But and that's why that one just comes to mind as like something that people will, you know, that's like, you know, the Gunstar heroes of the 360 era, right? Where, like, you know, the few people who had it will, you know, 10 years later will be like, yeah, that game ruled.
Yeah.
And like more people will discover it.
Yeah, I think that's how this kind of stuff is going to go. I also think that the Wii, that people will be nostalgic for the Wii because, you know, it was so popular.
Yeah.
So it was in all the households and people played some stuff, but some people will have also played things like, you know, No More Heroes is an easy, obvious one, but yeah. You know, Pandora's Tower or Xenoblade Chronicles.
Pantau.
Because the Wii was kind of Japan's last hurrah as a console game maker.
And what if they come back, though?
Well, as a console game maker, I don't think that's going to happen because I don't think there are going to be a lot more consoles. I mean, it could happen, but I don't know why it would. But regardless, it's definitely the end of the PS2 era of, like, I've got an idea and I have a certain amount of money.
Yeah.
And I have these assets, and I'm making this video game, and here it is.
Yeah, yes. And it's more importantly, I think it's like it's not just I have this much money and this asset, so let's do it. It's there is no digital market; it's all store shelves, and I can make a somewhat accurate prediction of how many units I'm able to sell.
Yeah, yeah.
If it's because I have this distribution network, you know, so like. That I actually think that the digital sort of killed the risky large budget games because you can't guarantee one sale anymore.
Yeah, yeah.
You could guarantee X thousands of units to Walmart almost, you know, very easily, especially in the days when you were exhibiting at E3 in order to, like, for its actual purpose.
Yeah, to meet with distributors and
right and get orders. So that you can then budget against that. So, you know, I think that, I don't know, like, I don't know how to replicate that era of spending on game budgets.
So we've got a comment that is from Tyler Tinsley. It says, kids today will be nostalgic for Naruto games. I pronounce Naruto in the non-superior Nihongo way because I imagine that's how Mr. Tyler Tinsley would want me to do it. It would be nostalgic for Naruto games and Minecraft, also Skylanders. I want to say I sort of disagree with that because, well, let's say Minecraft and Skylanders. Minecraft and Skylanders will still exist 20 or 30 years from now, and they'll still be very, very similar to what they are now. I feel like every new Skylanders / Minecraft is going to build on.
Yeah.
Like, that's what they do now. Now, here's the thing. Super Mario Bros. 1 and Super Mario Bros. 3 are, like, kind of drastically different games, right? I mean, Super Mario Bros. 2, the one that was released in the U.S., is an extremely different game, a huge departure from all of the Mario games. Like, so I think now we have this thing where when you make a sequel to something, you replace... You don't replace anything. You add, right? So that's what I'm saying about Pokemon and Dragon Quest is I don't think they're nostalgia. I think they're like what we would want nostalgia to be. I think it's idealized. It's the new version, you know, which is I don't know if it's nostalgia proof or what. But
well, I could see with Minecraft that people could be nostalgic for their creations that they made at a certain time and the people that they played with. Because, like, I've got friends who played Minecraft together, and they made stuff together, and, you know, those structures will probably maybe be stored somewhere, and then they could go back and look at that and be like, oh my god, my past is here.
But I disagree with you, Tim, because I think, at least with Minecraft, I think people are already nostalgic for the older versions of Minecraft. I think that for anyone who plays that game, it's going to hit a point where it outgrows that person. And I mean, Ultima Online still exists. But people are nostalgic for Ultima Online from 1997. You know,
for the experience, not in like a collector's aspect, though.
No, not a collector's aspect. But they're nostalgic for the rule set and the world that existed at that time. And not because they got older, but because, you know, the game kind of grew up without them after a while.
So I think with Skylanders, with like the toys, I think there's a lot of kind of potential for weird future feelings in there, because it's like, oh, I remember this particular Skylander. Like, maybe that's in there, I guess.
Oh, absolutely. Toys, yeah.
To Frank's point, I think one of the other things that I had written down was quote-unquote real MMOs, because I feel like the client-server MMO is... Yeah. Well, it's definitely on the decline now. Someone will probably do it again, but this era of that sort of MMO, especially the Western ones, it's way on the decline. And, you know, World of Warcraft is not the same game that it was 10 years ago.
But it's still too, like, recent and similar for people to be, like, really nostalgic about the game.
But in another 10 years...
It'll be on T-shirts and Target.
It's like, you know, Rogues Do It From Behind will be like a joke shirt on there, and it'll have a picture of the rogue, and people will be like, oh man, that rogue, that dark elf rogue or blood elf or whatever kind of elf they get. I don't know. Another example I had here, this is a weird one, but delisted games, like I'm sure somebody poured hours into that Toyota Yaris game because it was free and they could get it, and now it's gone. What's anyone gonna do about that? Like, there you can get the collector mentality, because people will try to excavate these from the depths, perhaps.
That just happened to me last week. Sharknado, the video game, has been delisted probably forever because of rights expiring. So that can happen real quick, it turns out.
That's very fast. Is that like a year and a half?
Yeah. Less than that, because it was end of July last year. So,
oh, wow.
Like a year and a couple months.
Yeah, that's pretty hardcore. So yeah. It's a weird thing. So I guess you got your copy. I mean, hey, my Oh Dear Alpha, that was out for a month and a half-ish before it was gone. That's, you know, nobody's going to have nostalgia for that thing, but it's weird. It's just weird the way that stuff can go away.
Yeah.
That's the side thing. Another one I had here was handhelds with cartridges.
Yeah. I think there's an appeal to having like 10 DS games in your bag.
Yeah.
You know that you don't have when you have 10 DS games on your DS.
And trading and that sort of thing.
Loaning.
Yeah. That's some cool stuff. Well, I've got more questions and more things to talk about, but we've basically reached the hour point.
I do want to I want to briefly just mention something that's really interesting to me in terms of nostalgia is Disneyland. The park has it's evolved quite a bit since 1955, and they keep adding new stuff, they keep replacing old things, but they managed to toe this weird line that I've not seen in anything else, in any media or anything, where they evolve the park but just keep enough of the old stuff to where, like, I don't think that even the most nostalgic Disney people are upset about any of the changes that they've made. And it's fascinating to me that they seem to find this weird formula where they, like, care to maintain the history that was there, but they also need to evolve the thing so that people keep coming, that, like, has managed to satisfy, you know, everyone but the craziest of their critics.
So what you're saying is that Disney should make the next Sonic game.
Yeah. Or the next World of Warcraft. I don't know. Right. But
I think what you're saying is Sonic should be in the next Kingdom Hearts game.
That is what I'm saying, yes.
Nice.
Yeah, that's pretty impressive. I cannot think of particularly anyone else that has done that or could do that.
Yeah, and it's like you can't leave that park alone because it was built in 1955 based on what Walt Disney was nostalgic for. You know, like, and it still has that same stuff. Like, it still has this Main Street that's modeled after like 19th century Main Street in some small town. You know, and that doesn't make sense to anyone anymore, but it's still there. And people are like nostalgic for the fake version that's there, not for the thing that it represents anymore. And that's, I don't know, there's that place. That, I don't know. I really am fascinated by Disneyland.
A lot of layers in there, certainly.
Yeah.
Disney layers.
to kind of end this up, I saw on Twitter today, Asher Vollmer, like right when I was writing this stuff down.
I know that guy.
He said, "The most flattered I've ever been was when someone ported threes to the Atari." And, you know, I also just learned that Volkar the Viking just came out on the Dreamcast for free. Like, you can download it and put it on a disc and then play it.
Yeah, that rules.
And, you know, just a couple months ago, I got a 3D printed Hue card for my PC Engine. It's like, This feeling is so powerful for people, especially it feels like people in sort of, I don't want to say nerdy. I just don't know what the word is. It's like stuff that's made for particular people.
Yeah.
For people that are like, that define themselves by their taste, whether they have it or not. It's really powerful for people and will cause them to make business decisions based on it or things that are unrelated or that shouldn't be business decisions, like releasing a new Genesis game.
You got you you, like you have not seen the retro VGS console, have you?
I've seen it. Yeah.
I mean, because this is exactly what you're talking about right now.
Yeah.
It's, you know, it was a bad business decision based on someone's nostalgia, which is that there should still be cartridge games.
Yeah.
And that should be enough to get $2 million or whatever.
Yeah, and there were enough people saying, oh my god, awesome, for the same reason that that guy on Facebook was like, oh my god, awesome, when he saw that there was a cartridge you could plug into your phone.
Yeah.
That had a worse experience for you. It's weird and interesting, and it's just, I almost feel like the DS, not the DS, sorry, the 3DS, or the Nintendo eShop, like, that's almost the current version of that, where, I think I've said this before, but every person I have asked, why did you release a game on Nintendo's eShop,
mm-hmm.
Knowing that the market is really rough, and they're like, well, I really like Nintendo. I played the NES when I was a kid, and it's interesting how powerful that stuff is for people.
Yeah.
Well, anyway, I guess that'll about wrap up this episode number 111.
111.
And I've been Brandon Sheffield at Necrosofty on Twitter.
Tim Rogers at 108.
I'm Frank Cifaldi at Frank Cifaldi.
Nice.
And you. Oh, and thanks to Blaine Brown for editing this together. You can
brain blown.
You can go to our Facebook page and enjoy us there. That's facebook.com/icpodcast. And feel free to send us emails and say hello and do whatever. And I guess we'll catch y'all next time.
Catch you like a baseball in a baseball glove. In the outfield, squinting at the sun. Later.
Oh, yeah! Podcast over.